don't care about Libya. Let the goddamned ragheads have their way. They're just a bunch of sand niggers anyhow. Why not blow them all away? Blow them all away. Blow them all away. I'd like to help keep America clean. Give me a shotgun and an M16. Blow them all away. And something else, you know I don't like faggots. Try to tell our kids that kind of shit's okay. Before they infect the whole damn human race, why not blow them all away? Blow them all away. Blow them all away. I'd like to help keep America clean. Give me a shotgun and an M16. Blow them all away. I particularly dislike commies. You know, the ones that teach the school children not to pray. Before you know it, they'll be kicking in your front door. Why not blow them all away? Blow them all away. Blow them all away. I'd like to help keep America clean. Give me a shotgun and an M16. Blow them all away. Blow them all away. Blow them all away. I'd like to help keep America clean. Give me a shotgun and an M16. Blow them all away.
Good evening and welcome to the third edition of the International Information Retrieval Guild's radio show, Bite Me, most politically incorrect radio show on the internet today. I'm your host, Mercenary, and in the studio with us tonight, here we have Black Ice.
Ice, baby.
Thomas Icom and Binary. Also with us in the studio tonight, we have St. Anarchy Guion Production and the IRG's favorite suspected National Socialist Workers Party's member, Hack Dog. On a quick note, Chaz couldn't be with us here tonight because he's on assignment down in Virginia. I really can't go into the details of his assignment, but the most prevalent rumor floating around the studio here tonight is that he's testing out his new high-powered laser window bounce listening system on some buildings down in the McLean and Arlington, Virginia area. We know he'll be listening in on the show later after he's done listening in on them, so we'd like to say greetings to Chaz down south, and you know we all expect some souvenir moonshine to be returned with you back to IRG World Headquarters. I'd like to start the show off tonight by replying to some email we received from last week's show. To answer Annie's and several anonymous users' questions about Black Ice's singing talents, the actual truth of the matter is that he absolutely has none. The song in question from last week's show is performed by Biker Joe Warren and not Black Ice. The IRG has a tradition of picking on members who don't make it to group meetings and group functions, and last week was Ice's turn. To answer your other question about CDs, on the U.S. East Coast, you can pick up Biker Joe's tapes and CDs at most larger bike rallies. We also appreciate your offer, and I think Ice might be contacting you to respond to that. I'd like to also respond to Script69's question about our studio and the layout of IRG World Headquarters. We received several inquiries over the last several weeks, and we don't want to divulge too much information about our location or our operational capabilities. But we will be posting some selected photos of portions of our facility shortly on our homepage. And yes, it is true, we have our own fully equipped bar. If you have a question for the IRG and would like a response here on Bite Me, please send your questions, comments, hate mail, letter bombs, and in Black Ice's case, any illicit offers to irg@irg.org, and those illicit offers go to black_ice@irg.org. Now, there's been a few recent developments I'd like to comment on. One of these being that some other hacking radio programs seem to have a fascination with world events. If you're going to have a quote-unquote hacking radio program, I believe the topic of the show should be hacking, computers and or electronics. I know as for myself, and speaking for several others, we couldn't give a rat's ass about the IMF or the World Bank. If you feel the need to protest against these organizations, fine. It's your right as a supposed free citizen in a democracy. But as Sane Anarchy is fond of saying and pointing out, peaceful protests don't accomplish jack shit. Look at the news today. Not a single goddamn article on the AP about your precious demonstrations. You were soon forgotten, and you were once again upstaged by a 60-year-old Cuban boat boy. Now, what other hacking programs, and I use that term loosely, should have been discussing is the news that a federal judge decided Monday that convicted computer hacker Kevin Mitnick is banned from taking part in a technology conference in Salt Lake City. Apparently, the judge won't let Mitnick appear because his prison release agreement prohibits him from consulting or advising on the topic of computer-related activity. Now, if Mitnick can appear before the Senate's Governmental Affairs Committee and advise them on computer security legislation, and that didn't violate his prison release agreement, then I think he should be allowed to speak at the UEDA conference. Otherwise, I'd say let's drag his fat ass back in and throw him back in jail for testifying before the Senate. Or does that old double standard apply? What is good for the government is good for the government, and what is good for you isn't good for the government. For those of you that require a plain English translation of that, that essentially means you can testify for us for free, but no, we can't let you make any money testifying to anyone else. Think about that one, folks, and see if that doesn't cause you a good case of brain rot. The other matter that some other radio programs should have been discussing is the fact that an arrest has been made in Canada for February's distributed denial of service attacks. This would have been right on the AP wire at their showtime, yet no mention was made of it. Today's news confirms that it was Mafia Boy that was arrested, and due to his age and his name isn't being released in accordance with the Canadian law. Now, I don't know if the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the FBI, and the U.S. Justice Department are just lazy or truly incompetent, but both our mailing list and the IRG's website, and also the Code of Silence's website, had enough information posted on them in February that even Hackdog would have had enough information to track down and apprehend Mafia Boy. I'm sure he would have bit him in the ass by now, too. Now, I'm assuming that since the early information we have is that only the attack on CNN is being specifically leveled against Mafia Boy, the American agencies are just looking for a scapegoat. We had already mentioned previously that Mafia Boy was just a script kiddie copycat attacker and had no real hacking skills. The FBI and the Justice Department have been under extreme pressure because of the lack of action. But since our sources tell us that the actual perpetrators of these attacks will be found in China, and that the FBI and the Justice Department cannot pursue them because they are in China, they needed a scapegoat to arrest and pacify their political puppet masters. Well, we hate to disappoint you guys, but if you don't apprehend the real perpetrators of these attacks, you're only making things worse for yourselves. If you thought the attacks in February were bad, that's only a preview of things to come. When you have hackers backed by communist overlords. I think you guys have a term for it. I believe you call it state-sponsored terrorism. Now, I know it's a novel concept to actually include hacker-related news items on a hacker-oriented radio program, but hopefully some other shows out there will catch on to the concept. Well, now that I've had my say for tonight, I'd like to turn the mic over to Binary. We'll be discussing DSL technology with you tonight. So without further ado, here he is.
Hi, this is Binary. This week I'll is going to be talking about implementing PPP over Ethernet under FreeBSD and Linux, but unfortunately SNET, our local exchange carrier, didn't meet their install date they gave me, so I didn't get to test anything because I don't have my line. So this week I'll be talking about DSL in general, how it works, and the different common types of service. DSL is a technology backed by telephone companies to provide next-generation high-bandwidth services to homes and businesses using existing telephone cabling. DSL to the home over existing phone lines promises bands with up to 9 megabits, but distance limitations and line quality conditions can reduce that will actually be achievable. DSL technologies use a greater range of frequencies over the cable than traditional telephone services, which in turn allows for greater bandwidth which to send and receive information. This technology is still in the early stages of rollout, with standards and products just getting underway. Driving the market heavily is the competition from competing access providers and the pursuit of internet providers to get customers money. There are several forms of DSL, each designed around specific goals and needs of the marketplace. Some forms of DSL are proprietary, some are simply theoretical models, and some are widely used standards. They mainly differ with the modulation methods used to encode data. A few of the popular standards are ADSL, or Asymmetric Digital Subscriber Line. This is the most popular form of DSL technology. The key to ADSL is that the upstream and downstream bandwidth is asymmetric. In practice, bandwidth from the provider to the users, or downstream, will be higher than the upstream. This is due in part to the limitations of telephone cabling systems and the desire to accommodate the typical internet usage pattern, of where the majority of the data being sent to the user, like programs, graphics, sound, and video, and they only need minimal upload capability, with keystrokes or mouse clicks. Downstream speeds typically range from 1.5 megabits to 9 megabits. Upstream ranges typically range from 6 kilobits to 1.5 megabits. The next common standard is HDSL, or High Bitrate Digital Subscriber Line. This is generally used as a substitute for T1 connectivity or DS1 connectivity. HDSL is becoming popular as a way to provide full duplex symmetric data communication at rates up to 1.55 megabits over moderate distances using conventional telephone twisted pair wires. Traditional T1 connections require repeaters every 6,000 feet to boost signal strength. HDSL has a longer range than that of traditional, and with distances up to 12,000 feet. It uses pulse amplitude modulation on a four-wire loop opposed to SDSL, which is a two-wire implementation of HDSL, with distances up to 11,000 feet. The name has become more generic over time to refer to symmetric service at a variety of rates over a single loop. One of the proposed standards that isn't fully ratified yet is VDSL, Very High Bitrate Digital Subscriber Line. It's proposed for shorter local loops, perhaps up to 3,000 feet. Data rates are expected to exceed 10 megabits. Well, that's all I'm going to babble about this week. Maybe next week, Snow will finally get my line installed, and I'll be able to talk about implementing it. Till next week, later.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to bring on Black Ice now. He's going to update you on a few projects we've got going, and a few new projects he's got in mind. So without any further ado, here he is.
Greetings all, Black Ice here. Well, you guys missed me last week. You got to hear a little bit of somebody else's singing. I just want to thank you all for the wonderful email I got. And Cypher Chick, if you're out there, I'll take you up on that offer. Sounds like a plan. Anyway, on the first show, I commented on how to receive a free t-shirt from 2600 Magazine.
Oh, Emmanuel, Hunter, this is the best 12th birthday present I ever had!
Well, considering their lack of quality control, it's not that difficult. The magazine I'm going to comment on now does not suck and does not give you a t-shirt for any article submitted. But then again, if they accept any articles from you, you probably have something worthwhile to say and can probably get a pretty penny for it. That magazine is Scanning USA. Check out www.scanningusa.com for information. For those RF enthusiasts, it's worth a check. It's a print zine that costs only $2.95 a month should you want a copy, and the information within will keep you busy for a while. On another subject matter, certainly of interest for me and some other people, is the PlayStation 2. Since its inception in Japan, it has had mixed reviews and a troublesome release. Initially, they suffered from bad coding that would delete the DVD operation when you saved on certain games. They also allowed Region 1 and 2 playback on their DVDs, which was normally reserved for PC applications only. Subsequently, they had recalled all the stations sold at that time. They're not expecting to get all of them returned due to its capabilities to copy those DVDs to tape with no issue. My suggestion, if you have one of the PSX2s, hang on to it. It might be worth something in the barter and trade area as products get more and more restrictive. Certainly by the time of US release, we will have a downgraded version catered to our Region 1. They also toyed with the export restrictions due to the PSX2 being looked at as being used for missile delivery systems. This export restriction has been discontinued, so it's back to normal. Also, with Microsoft's announcement on the Xbox, their attempt at the console demographics, Sony responded with the upgrade of the PSX2 to a 8GB hard drive and 56K modem that will come with the PSX2 for the US release, a definitive argument that competition is good. A lot of people have asked me about the possibility of the modification of the PlayStation 2 to accept your older imported PlayStation games. The IRG Mod Squad is presently compiling information on this subject matter. Sony developed a one-laser reading system for their DVD players that has been placed into the PlayStation 2. This system is highly sensitive and restrictive on what media it can read. This will not affect any press CDs for that matter. What is unknown at this time is how the PlayStation 2 will process the country code that's inherent in all legit PlayStations at this time. seeing they changed reading capabilities to suit a more cost-effective and anti-piracy product, it's only natural to assume they have buffered the country code process. So those of you out there with legit copies of Japanese games and a modified PlayStation, I wouldn't turn in your PSX anytime soon. You might want to pick up another one for backup. I will be compiling all the information, and the Mod Squad has gotten this together and will be putting it in an upcoming Fantasy release. As for the SIGINT project I started, thank you very, very much for all your input and feedback. I will compile that data, barring any names, and put it on my RF hacking page for all to peruse. If you want any credit on that page for the stuff that you sent in to me, let me know and I'll certainly tag your name on it. All that aside, I'm going to pass the mic on over to Thomas Icom. He's going to do some discussions too. I want to thank you all for your time. You have a wonderful evening.
Good evening. This is Thomas Icom, and you are listening to Bite Me, the official radio program of the International Information Retrieval Guild. Okay, starting this evening, I've got a couple reviews here. Some of you have sent me some email regarding whether or not the Resistor still exists. Now, the Resistor is the official periodical of the Special Forces Underground. There are a few copies on the CSA website, which again is at www.irg.org/tildeticom/survival.html. Now, as I was saying, the Resistor is the official periodical of the Special Forces Underground. In their own words, the philosophy of the Resistor is straightforward. Strict constitutionalism, isolationism, laissez-faire capitalism, individual rights, limited government, and republicanism. The Resistor opposes statism, liberalism, tribalism, socialism, collectivism, internationalism, democracy, altruism, pole politics, and the New World Order. Now, the Resistor is a print periodical. It's available via subscription through mail only. Subscriptions are $50 for four issues. Now, that may seem like a lot, but the Resistor is in 8.5x11 format, and each issue runs about 150 to 200 pages. And the information you'll find in there, both news and operational information, is 10 times better than anything else you're going to find in terms of survivalist or militia-type publications. Those of you who've seen the digital issues on the Connecticut Survivalist Alliance's webpage know what I'm talking about. At any rate, the subscriptions are $50 for four issues. You can send either cash, money order, or check, and please leave the pay to the order of section blank if you're sending them a money order or check, and allow 5 weeks for your distribution to begin. Be sure to include your name and address. As far as that, sending them a blank money order goes, I had a chat and know the guy who publishes the Resistor. He's a straightforward fellow, so you don't have to worry about not receiving a subscription. Anyway, their address is The Resistor, P.O. Box 35046. That's in Fayetteville, Fayetteville, North Carolina. Zip is 28303, and that's in the good old United States of America. We also got a book in, which I'm going to do a little quick review and recommendation. Those of you who are familiar with the IIRG survival pages know we think rather highly of Ragnar Benson. He's a writer. He's written for Paladin Press as well as Limpanix. Very prolific survivalist writer. Many of his books were actually taken off the market as a result of the agreement that Paladin Press made when they were getting sued over their Hitman book. Well, Ragnar has a new one out. It's called Ragnar's Urban Survival, A Hard Times Guide to Staying Alive in the City. It goes into rather interesting detail on all sorts of things. Basic survival philosophy, combat and built-up areas, the government's view of survivalists, water, sources of energy, food, survival food preparation, emergency shelter in cities, caching and storage, trading, guns, and survival nursing. It's in digest format. It runs a tad under 200 pages, and I would say this is a good one to put in your survival library, and that is available through Paladin Press, and you can check out their website at www.paladin-press.com. Continuing on, we're going to talk a little bit about the wireless underground digital network that some of you may have heard of, that has been discussed previous times on Bite Me, and also on the IIRG's webpage. You know, sending data over the airwaves actually predates the internet. Back in the 60s, hams were using a 5-bit code known as baud-o to communicate over HF, shortwave amateur bands. The devices they used were large electromechanical affairs known as teletypes, and they ran at speeds of 45 and 75 baud. Baud-o is still used on HF, along with good old ASCII running at 110 and 300 baud, and other more modern digital nodes such as mTOR and PSK. Back in the late 80s, packet radio made its appearance running AX25, which is a ham radio version of the X25 protocol used by packet switch networks. That's running at 300 and 1200 baud. Hams set up this massive AX25 digital network, which on the East Coast stretched from Maine to Florida and inland to the Mississippi River. However, the rise of the internet caused a decline of packet radio's popularity. Packet radio requires an amateur radio license, where internet does not. Packet radio's top speed for the average end user is generally limited to 9600 baud, with 1200 baud being the most common, whereas the average internet user comes in at 56k over the phone lines, and faster if they use a cable modem. Packet radio requires more technical expertise to get up than internet service, and this is all generally beyond the means and intelligence of the average denial-of-service exploit script hacker, whose main concern appears to be acting his sexual frustrations out on random computer systems. Now, certain white hat hacker groups, also known as security consultants, have been attempting to implement a wireless underground network. This has been unsuccessful to date because of their insistence of wanting a wireless high-speed TCP/IP backbone with a ton of superfluous bells and whistles as the foundation for the network, the legal issues with accessing the internet via the amateur bands, the short-range and high-cost Apart 15 wireless networking devices, and basically a general lack of serious interest amongst many of the hackers they recruit. With many white hats now doing InfoSec for corporate interests in a blatant manner, one also must begin to wonder just how underground such a network would be if it were implemented by them. Now, there have been other hobbyist organizations which have implemented wireless internet on a small scale in their locales. Well, this is all fine and dandy. I don't consider them underground networks due to the fact that they are operating in a totally overt manner and are connected to the internet. Let's face it. The internet is great for downloading technical and product support information, emailing friends and family, expanding one's non-computer hobbies, and getting the latest news and weather. As the basis for an underground network, it quite frankly sucks, and I fully expect the feds to step in and muscle more restrictions on it in the future. It's happening the same way it started with our Second Amendment rights, highly publicized incidents followed by a call to action by the experts. By the way, you know what a definition of expert is? Well, X is a scientific equation meaning unknown, and a PERT is a drip under pressure, so I guess that means an expert is an unknown drip under pressure. Anyway, if you're looking to be able to surf the web and download megabyte multimedia files in 30 seconds while at the beach for only $19.95 plus shipping and handling, forget it. If you want to be part of an effective wireless underground network, then I'm going to show you how, and it will work. The equipment is inexpensive and is available off the shelf at any business that sells amateur radio equipment. The cost of the equipment can be as little as $200 per station, provided you are willing to expend the effort to do so. Battery-operated stations are capable of being fitted into a 50-caliber military surplus ammo can with a solar-powered trickle charger and placed on a remote hilltop to act as a relay station for months of unattended operation. While this network does not have indigenous encryption, it will support the encryption system of your choice. This, like other aspects of the network, allows you to customize specifics to suit your needs, thus increasing OPSEC, also known as operational security. While I'm of the belief that telling the world what type of encryption you're using only gives your enemies one more thing with which to screw you with. While it may be fine and dandy for the white hackers and the academic idiots to allow themselves to play with each other's crypto. We are simply interested in good communication security. There's plenty of information out there as to what works and what doesn't, and if you decide to use a Caesar cipher on your system, you have no one to blame but yourself. Now, as far as equipment goes, you only need the following to get up and running. You'll need a radio. Most people are acquiring a dual-band 2-meter 70-centimeter, that's 144 and 440 megahertz, dual-band ham HT that has been modified for out-of-band use. These radios typically have a maximum power output of 5 watts over a frequency range of 140 to 174 and 420 to 470 megahertz. You may also upgrade to a base or mobile unit which offers a power output of 25 to 50 watts depending on the make and model. You'll need a terminal node controller. This is a 1200 baud AX25 radio modem that interfaces between your terminal and your radio. And you'll also need an RS-232 terminal. You can use anything that has an RS-232 port, PC, Mac, Commodore 64, Atari, or even an old DEC VT100 terminal if that's what you have. All the work is done via the TNC. You also need some sort of antenna system. All HTs come with a stock rubber duck antenna, but you should upgrade to at least a home-built dipole, quarter-wave vertical, or J-pole antenna. With a good antenna, even running 5 watts will give you decent range. You'll need a 12-volt power supply. For a little 5-watt HT, you can get by with your basic 3-amp Radio Shack supply. A 50-watt mobile will require a larger 20-amp supply, such as an Astron or similar make. Hooking all this stuff up is relatively simple. Specific instructions will be included with the equipment you purchase, but it'll be along these lines. Your power supply is hooking into your radio and TNC. Your computer running your terminal program has an RS-232 connection running to your TNC, and from your TNC to your radio, you generally have a connection for your speaker output, your mic audio input to the radio, and the push-to-talk control line for your radio. It's not too difficult, and that's basically the foundation of the IIRG's network, NewNet, the New England Wireless Network, and that equipment's all you're going to need in order to get access if you're in the New England area, specifically Connecticut. With this simple setup, you'll have the capability of both maintaining a local communications net with your group and integrating with larger networks consisting of other groups in your region and eventually across the country. We'll be discussing more of the nuts, bolts, hints, and kinks involved in setting up a functional underground wireless digital communications network, not only here on Byte Me, but also in future issues of Fantasy. And as always, you can send your comments and questions via email to me at TICOM, that's TICOM as in Mary, at IIRG.org. There's also a room dedicated to this purpose set up on our Telnet BBS, Postcards from the Edge. Just telnet to luna.iirg.org, enter in a user ID of BBS and no password. And that's all I've got for this evening. I'm going to turn it over to Mercenary. Have a good evening.
Hey, thank you, TICOM, for that rousing introduction. Tonight, for my closing comments, I'd like to take a minute and give you a little commentary. I've been asked on our IRC channel why I poke so much fun at 2600 and the loft. I feel that this is a legitimate question which needs a legitimate answer. The IRG has been around since 1982, and we're probably the only remaining original hacking group that hasn't sold out to the government or the corporate world. We aren't media whores, and we don't jump in front of every camera that passes our way. I've declined more interviews than I care to remember. I have nothing against making a buck or two, but I don't feel that if you go over the fence, per se, and become a security consultant, you can still call yourself a hacker. What would I say if a corporate interest offered us $10 million in financial backing? I can honestly say I don't know. What I do know is that I can never sell out my contacts or fellow IRG members. How can you one day call yourself a hacker and then the next day use information obtained through contacts or underground sources against the individuals you once called your peers? No amount of financial backing could give me a clear conscience when I looked at myself in the mirror each morning. Some of my fellow IRG members share this feeling. Some don't. Some people say that my comments are harsh and cruel. All I have to say is to those people is that if you can't take the heat, get out of the fucking kitchen. I've never been politically correct, and I never will be. Do I have anything against anyone personally, I've been asked? No. I've chatted and partied with many individuals who have gone over to what I prefer to call the dark side or the corporate world. Would I discuss hacking matters with these individuals now? No. In absolutely no way, shape, or form would I discuss hacking with them. Would I sit down and discuss non-hacking related matters and have a beer? Sure. Why not? No harm to myself or anybody else. If they ask me about hacking, I'd just say, No comment. All I know is that if I ever jump over the fence, the IRG will not exist under my leadership, and I would no longer use my handle Mercenary. As for 2600 Magazine, what can I say? They were once a decent publication that seems to have lost their way over time. In my personal opinion, Eric Corley is far more interested and concerned with what individuals and issues can get him in front of the camera and more impressive press exposure than actually furthering any hacking issues or publishing any truly informative material. Some disagree with me, that's your right, but don't expect me to shut up just because you don't agree with me. It's called a difference of opinion. Live with it. 2600 also appears to be under the impression that its readers are a group of lemmings, rejecting articles because they are too technically complicated for our readers. It's truly a sad day when you classify your readers as morons. If 2600 truly wants to be the Hacking Quarterly, they have to learn not to selectively choose who and what they want to support because they'll get mainstream media attention. I think it's time Eric decides whether he truly wants to support hackers or get on 60 Minutes. Sure, it's fine to support the likes of Bernie S. and Kevin Mitnick, yet not even a hint of support for Trout from Bo, who is essentially furthering 2600's cause in his own way. Where's the fairness in journalism in that? It's the very bullshit Corley espouses to support, yet when it doesn't get him on 2020, he could care less. Drop me a note at irg@irg.org, and let me know what you think. Am I right? Am I wrong? Haven't been out drinking all night. Well, that's it for me tonight. We'll talk to you next week. Now, St. Anarchy, take me on out of here.
I'm gonna tell y'all a story you ain't gonna believe. It's about UFOs, big rigs, and barbecue. Well, I'm squishing armadillos out on Interstate 10. Heading out of Houston once again.
Truck driving, carbuckle-butted ears, let me tell ya.
Well, I-